From Flourish DX, this is the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. With workplace mental health becoming a safety prerogative, this is the source of information on psychological injury prevention and health promotion.
Jason Vinci, welcome to the Safe to Adapt Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you have just come out of the gates rip-roaring with a new podcast called the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. So tell the Safety Attack listeners a bit about that.
Yeah, so I guess my background is organizational psychology, and I guess I'm predisposed to looking at more systemic approaches to workplace outcomes, whether they be productivity, whether it's teamwork, whether it's mental health and well-being. Yeah. And I guess over the last probably 5 or 6 years, I've noticed that there is a huge focus on the well-being side of things, the individual side, you know, when we talk about employee mental health in particular, right? So you'll hear people be asked to be more resilient, manage their stress better, become more mindful in order to manage the stress that's arising from either their home life or their work life. Mm-hmm. And I don't mind that. And in fact, I really like the field of positive psychology, which is all about well-being psychology. How do we keep people well and optimize their well-being to assist them to flourish? But I guess what I've been doing more recently in the last few years is going back to my roots with that org psych background and thinking more about, well, what is the employer's role in mental health outcomes? And, you know, how can we use a shared responsibility model, very similar to what we use in, say, fatigue risk management? And I've got a bit of a background in that area as well.
Okay.
In order to keep employees well and to optimize their well-being.
Yeah, cool. Do you think psych health and safety, well, let's talk some definitions first before we get to anything. I'm having more and more guests on the podcast talking in the areas of psychosocial risk and mental health and mental illness. Not all the same thing. You and I have both had the pleasure of speaking with Carlo Capanecchia. He was on episode 39 of the Safety on Tap podcast, which I think is an awesome starting place for people to kind of just get the 101 introduction in a snippet about psychosocial risk factors and whatnot. So let's just like go through the basics. Mental health, mental illness, wellness, psychological health and safety, and psychological safety. You can start wherever you would like.
Yeah, okay. Well, one of my pet peeves actually is when people use the term psychological safety and psychological health and safety interchangeably. Mm-hmm. So they're actually two very different constructs. Even though they both can influence employee mental health outcomes, they are very different. So yeah. Psych safety is more about people feeling like they have the ability to voice what they feel without repercussions.
Yep.
And so it's all about trust, culture, that sort of thing within an organization, which, as you can understand, does have direct benefits for employee mental health.
Yeah.
Psych health and safety, though, is more about applying risk management principles to the identification and management of psychosocial hazards. And yep. As Carla would have talked about, you know, they're the things that cause people to be stressed, either ongoing or exposure to very high levels of stress, like, you know, occupational violence or bullying and harassment. So. Yep. Yeah, so what the podcast is all about is actually looking more at the health and safety lens to psychosocial risk management, if you like, yeah. As compared to, you know, this idea of culture or voice that psychological safety covers.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, psychological safety, most popularized by Amy Edmondson and her colleagues' work, is actually really, like, it's really fantastic stuff. It's almost a bit of a shame that they chose to put those two words together, psychological safety, to describe their mm-hmm. construct, because you're right. It is really useful. It can be helpful in lots of circumstances. It is something we can influence, and improving psychological safety improves a bunch of psychological health and safety, but it is easy to get confused, isn't it? So, I mean, where do you find that discussion around that clarity or that confusion when you're talking with leaders, with health and safety professionals? I mean, how do you think generally people are getting it or not getting it?
I'd say probably 90% don't get it, Andrew.
Okay.
And so you have to bring it up early in the conversation. I actually even noticed someone who wrote a book just in the last couple of years on the topic of psych safety and is getting heaps of publicity about it, also conflates the two constructs.
So, in the book?
Yeah, and in other you know, webinars and stuff that he's presented on, I don't think he understands the difference between the two, to tell you the truth. So,
can you say who that is, just so our listeners don't go down a rabbit hole?
If you look on Wikipedia, whoever the guy's name is, he published a book in 2019, but that just goes to show that anyone can publish a book these days without peer review. Again, we use an evidence base, and you know, there are some people out there who don't draw on that, and I think it's very, very confusing. And I think this idea of psychological safety, even though it started with really good roots, like you say, with the likes of Edmondson, I think it's gone down more of a pop psychology route now, unfortunately, because there's people who are getting on the bandwagon who aren't drawing on an evidence base for it.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think too that the psychological safety stuff, without spending too much time on that, came out of some work that was done by psychologists, people who understand psychology, and they talked a lot about other psychological constructs, but it's not org psych and it's not clinical psych. And I think that, I mean, probably one of the most helpful things that a specialist in this space said to me recently was previous guest Dave Burrows, where he talked about bringing together the two disciplines of clinical psych and org psych is a really good way to draw on the evidence base for actually improving work for individuals and groups at work. But I understand how it is easy to get confused with them.
Yeah, and I totally agree with David as well. Clinical psychs and org psychs, even though we're both psychologists, we have complementary skill sets. And if we think about the integrated model of workplace mental health, where we can intervene at the three levels of, you know, mitigate illness, prevent harm, promote flourishing, you can imagine the clin psychs would be really useful, particularly down that pointy end, the mitigate illness, whereas org psychs, I think, have, you know, probably a broader range of skill sets to help with that prevent harm and promote flourishing area.
Yeah, cool. So one of the really common objections that I hear still, or maybe not even objections, but things that people grapple with, leaders and health and safety professionals, is, well, where is this boundary? Where is this line that we need to draw between someone who comes to work as a worker and someone who is an individual human being outside of work? You know, where are the lines in our duty of care? And where is the, I suppose, even the horizon of the opportunity to leverage improving mental health or physical, sorry, psychosocial health and wellness for the benefits of work? So it seems like there's this boundary issue. What are the sorts of things that you're hearing from people about where the boundary is, where they're confused, and how you help them get clearer on it?
Yeah, you must have listened to some of our previous episodes, Andrew, because it's a common theme that's coming out.
Okay. It's a bit of a leading question.
Thank you for that. Let me hit a home run with this one. So you know, there is a lot of dissension from leaders or, you know, HR managers or whoever they are in organizations who are saying, no, people are doing stuff in their time off that's causing them to be stressed. Yeah. We can't help it that they're going through a divorce. We can't help it that, you know, they've got a problem child or someone's sick in their family or something like that. They're bringing it to work. And it's funny because the probably most popular way to address mental health at work is something that it actually helps people with their individual stress as much as the workplace stress, which is employee assistance programs. Now, you know what? Employers don't actually have a workplace health and safety obligation to provide employee assistance programs. There is no legal responsibility for that.
And yet they're very popular.
They're very popular, right?
That's what people point to when they say, this is what we're doing about it.
We're tick box. We've done it. We've got an EAP, right? And sure, I know, and there's going to be some EAP providers that are going to try and cut me down after this interview. But I know EAPs are doing more stuff proactively as well, and as much as the organizations that they work with will allow them to do that. But the majority of this stuff is often focused at the individual level still, trying to help them deal with their stress rather than looking at the occupational context that contributes to stress. And this is where the employer's obligation lies. It's not around trying to help someone work through their individual issues. Even though that's a popular approach through the provision of EAP, they assist them with that. What the employer's obligation is to create a healthy and safe work environment so that when people come to work, then they don't go home ill. And in fact, if you do it well, they'll actually go home in a better way than when they arrived. And that's through understanding the design of work and making sure that we engineer out any hazards, the psychosocial hazards, again, like workload or lack of role clarity or lack of autonomy, to keep them safe. So that's the employer's role. Just because EAP is the most popular way we deal with workplace mental health doesn't mean that is the employer's role. That's a nice add-on. It's kind of like an employer of choice that it's highly desirable to have because it's kind of like expected now. But really, that is not the employer's obligation.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dave Burrows and I talked about this in the sense that EAPs often, so as you say, it's not a problem in and of itself. It's actually a helpful part of an overall strategy, but it's the mm-hmm. missing strategy that's the problem, whereby we might measure things like increasing uptake of EAP or the kind of thematic analysis or trending or whatever that we get out of those services because they want to be able to show you that your money's going somewhere. And yet that's actually really disconnected from, as you say, a first principles approach to, well, what dials are we trying to move here for mental health or psychosocial risk?
That's right. The EAPs are really focused on primarily dealing with the symptoms of workplace stress, not dealing with the root cause.
And often after the fact too, you know, we often have to wait for things.
Yeah. It's reactive. And like you say, you get lagging data by, you know, how many people are using it and for what common things are they using it?
Yeah.
And again, but that's at an individual level. It's not necessarily, doing a risk assessment properly to understand what are the psychosocial hazards that are at play here.
Yeah. Awesome. Now, you mentioned the word obligation before, which is kind of interesting. It means lots of different things to lots of different people. So given the Safety Untapped podcast is listened to by people in 74 different countries, obviously that's going to mean different things to different people. So can you just give us a bit of an introduction into how you see the legal obligation for psych health and safety, not just in Australia, but in other places as well?
Yeah, so basically wherever you're in a country that has a general duty of care provision in your legislation, that means that there will be provisions for psych health and safety that you not just have to engineer out or understand and engineer out the physical hazards in the work environment, like working at high confined spaces, that sort of thing, but also consider the psychosocial hazards and how you're managing them. We had Peter Kelly actually from the UK HSC, a good mate of mine now, on episode 3, mm-hmm. talking to some of the clauses under their regs that actually deal with this. So clause 3, you need to do risk assessment. Clause 5, you need to mitigate risks based on that risk assessment.
Yeah.
But you'll find, like New South Wales, Safe Work New South Wales found when they interviewed workplaces around this, the vast majority of them are not dealing with psychological risks systematically.
Now, you mentioned a number to me the other day about that. Wasn't it less than 10%? Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah, that's right. So in their research, and actually we're going to have Ian Firth, hopefully maybe in the same week that this episode comes out on our podcast from Safe Work New South Wales, talk to those stats.
Yeah.
It was 8.8%, you said, percent of companies. It was on a self-assessment, said that they were dealing with psychological risks in a systematic manner.
Yeah, cool. So, but it's possible that they could read that question and their brain says, we have an EAP and a policy. So those numbers may very well be, again, I don't know the statistical term, higher than the reality might be anyway.
Yeah, they might be generous. And I think they are, knowing, you know, the majority of organisations do not have formal processes in place for risk assessment and risk management of psychosocial hazards. Yeah. Some will say they're doing risk assessment because they have an employee engagement survey and they're collecting some things that can be associated with psychosocial hazards.
Sure.
They're not actually doing the follow-up to really understand those hazards qualitatively.
Yeah. What's the biggest Achilles heel? I mean, this idea around risk management is not new to most of the people who are listening to us. Even if you are in a legal system that's more prescriptive, like in the US, this idea of mental health and what goes on inside people's heads, not just in their bodies, is not new. Some of the legislative provisions, in fact, in some places have been around for quite some time, 5 years, 10 years, even longer. We know that the workers' compensation systems have been really struggling. As you mentioned in the first episode of your podcast, you talked about the growth in psychological related claims is outstripping by an order of magnitude physical claims. So like none of this is new. What's the Achilles heel here in terms of actually making a change?
I think there's two. So I think we do need clearer legislation. So even though the Act here in Australia and other legislation internationally will talk about health and it's supposed to encompass both physical and mental health, what you'll find is that most people just interpret it or employers interpret it as physical health. I think the other one is that many health and safety professionals kind of don't feel that mental health or psychological health and safety is their responsibility. It's largely under the HR kind of banner. You know, this is something that they do. But when HR look at it, it's typically, again, at an individual level, EAP, lunch and learns, that sort of thing. It's not systematic. It's not risk-based.
Yeah.
And that's obviously why Marie Boland, in her 2018 review of the WHS Act here in Australia, out of 34 recommendations, recommendation number 2 was to let's encompass psychological health more in the Act, not just physical health, or just rely on this health definition to make it clearer what employers' obligations are. Yeah. And also why we're now seeing things like ISO 45003, the first international standard on psychological health and safety at work, actually falling under 45001, which is Occupational Health and Safety Management System. Yep. So clearly there's a lot of movement both locally and internationally to go, well, you know what, this is actually a health and safety issue. We need health and safety to become more involved in this if we're going to prevent harm and keep people well.
Yeah, cool. It was interesting when Carlo and I caught up on the podcast all those many months ago in episode 39, we kind of had a bit of an interesting debate, because Carlo has a very, very strong view, I had at the time, that the OH&S part of the business, the systems, the strategy, the resourcing, the risk management, et cetera, is just perfectly placed to move the dial on this. And I kind of thought I had a bit of a different view, because if you think about what you said just then, that a lot of health and safety leaders, and then in turn systems, they struggle with influencing the design of work. And so this is exactly the same whether you are in a construction or engineering company, and we're talking about not making the equipment in the building difficult for a person to maintain it in the future. You know, these are safety and design, or in the UK, you know, CDM kind of principles. The same thing with the design of work in terms of autonomy and role clarity and workload and pressure and that sort of speed, etc. These are all those factors that Carlo mentioned and you've talked about on your podcast as well. So, like, we might say that it seems logical to sit it in the workplace or occupational health and safety space, but like, are we really in the right place? You know, like, are we still not going to struggle because we do things like, you know, oh, well, that's HR over there, you know? I'm not being very articulate. Do you know what I'm getting at?
No. And I understand definitely where you're coming from. And I can tell you from our discussion with Carlo in episode 5 of our podcast, he definitely hasn't changed his opinion.
Good.
But I kind of look at it a little bit different to Carlo, okay? So very similarly, but there are some key differences.
Yeah.
But you just kind of answered it yourself as well. In if you think about the role of health and safety, it is not to actually engineer the solutions. Mm-hmm. They are to risk assess and they are to monitor, right? They work with professionals like engineers to put up guardings, or, you know, design work environments so that they're safer, or they work with hygienists to, you know, improve the physical working conditions for employees. In much the same way, we don't expect health and safety professionals are supposed to design work or to address things like change consultation or leadership behaviours. That is definitely the role of HR, OD, org psychs.
Yeah.
But in much the same way as they work with engineers, they can work with these professionals in order to, once they've identified the hazard, to allow them to mitigate it, right, and then to continue to monitor. So the way I look at it is, if you think about your public health model where you got primary, secondary, tertiary prevention, primary prevention is work design. That's where HR, OD come in. They should be recruiting people properly, getting the right people in for the right role, and they should be designing work so that there is autonomy, there are positive relationships in there, people do get a sense of meaning and accomplishment and a chance to leverage their strengths.
Yeah.
However, at the secondary prevention level, once we're starting to identify that there's signs of stress or psychosocial hazards in the work environment that are causing people to become ill, then that's where job redesign might come in. Right. Mm-hmm. So we do work design first, job redesign at that secondary level, once health and safety or HR or a combination of the two have identified a risk. But then it goes back to HR, OD to actually identify how do we actually fix this thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely. And Wade Needham spoke to the need for HR and health and safety to work more closely together in psychological health and safety on episode 2.
Yep.
And definitely that is the same way as health and safety already work with engineering in order to engineer work environments.
Yeah, cool. So can you tell us some stories? I mean, some of this stuff, I one of my specialty roles in the past has been around physical safety and design. I was responsible for steering the strategy for the physical safety and environment in design for the National Broadband Network, our Australia's Australia's wholesale broadband network across the entire country.
So you're the person to blame, eh?
No, not to blame. It's interesting though, thinking about legacy here and design, and I suppose this is the root of the question, right? Which is that I know that I can move the dial on safety and design if I influence the right people at the right stage of the process to put the roadside cabinet here, not there. And I know that every single time a worker needs to be working there, or as often happens, a car ends up driving through it. I know that we've done as much as we can to reduce the risk as reasonably practicable. You know, that's kind of the as much as we can hope to achieve. The cool bit is that I know that that happened 100,000 times because we just did the design once and it would, you know, it rolled out 100,000 times to the extent that, you know, that was the design that was used. So it's kind of one of those things where often in a physical safety or an engineering or a safety and design sense, we kind of go, will we get it right at the right stage? Or for the life cycle of whatever that is, we're kind of stuck with it. Mm-hmm. And yet the way that I tend to think about job design and in relation to changing the factors that impact on psychosocial risk, that it's actually really easy for us to change those things because it's literally as simple as changing what you ask someone to do next week at the informal level, all the way through to rewriting a job description or sitting down with a team to redistribute responsibilities and, you know, maybe a bit of process engineering in terms of this team giving that team stuff or whatever it is, right? But it's actually not as complicated as having a 50-year life cycle network or whatever have those problems built into it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, whilst we might try and design work from the outset to, you know, have all these characteristics setting it and keep people well and help them to be productive and all the rest, you know, sometimes we miss things or, you know, the personnel changes, the culture changes, the role changes, you know, over time. Yeah. And that's why it's very much about this continuous improvement, right? We need to have a cycle of consultation with employees, not just as you can in maybe a big project like you're talking about, where you can kind of design it to be safe from the outset and have, you know, hundreds of thousands of work hours without incident. I think when it comes to psychosocial hazards, we need to make sure that we're actively seeking feedback from employees and then attending to that in a continuous improvement manner.
Yeah, cool. What do you say to people when they say, because we've talked about this tension that exists, you know, org psychs look at the world as we need to improve systems of work, or we have the opportunity to improve systems of work, and they're the things that affect psychosocial outcomes. You might have a clinical psych who's going to have their natural bias of the individual and what's going on inside their head and their life and their responses, et cetera. So I think that there's always this tension that exists around the individual and their context more broadly. So what do you say to people when, let's say, for example, where we're talking about discussing with someone, say in response to a psychological incident or a decline in their mental health? How do you balance this tension between kind of saying, well, no, you know, we need square pegs here in this team and we can't just whittle the edges off for round pegs. How do you manage this tension in a practical sense? Because that's something that I hear from health and safety professionals all the time. It seems to be a messy question.
Yeah, and I think this comes down to recruitment. You got to go and find the right people for the right role. It comes down to having accurate job descriptions and not just have you know, these are the skills that are required and these are kind of the day-to-day tasks, but also as, you know, health and safety practitioners do, look at the physical demands of the role and then also maybe list the emotional or psychological demands of the role as well. Yep. So when we have a really good view of what the role is and the requirements and the demands, then we can better recruit for that position. So psychosocial health and safety actually starts even pre-recruitment, right, by really understanding what we're recruiting for. And then selecting the right people based on a number of characteristics. And that's again where psychologists can come in and do personality profiling and abilities assessment and that sort of thing to try and find that right fit and the person who's going to meet the demand. In fact, I remember when I was doing my master's degree quite a while ago now, we have to do 3 practical placements as part of this, like 30 or 40 days each, because it is quite a practical degree. And one of mine was with the organizational psychology unit at the WA Police. And what I had to do was a number of the psychological interviews for police recruits coming through. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most daunting parts of the recruitment process for wanting to be police officers, right?
Yeah.
And it's all about understanding, okay, this is a very demanding role. What these people are going to see in the role is going to be horrifying to a lot of people and very traumatic. So it's really at that point trying to filter out those people who are going to be able to cope with those psychological demands. So when we think about roles and we know that there's going to be exposure to things like vicarious trauma or other sorts of trauma, then we really need to be mindful of those psychological demands and recruit accordingly.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've had a discussion on the podcast, I can't remember the episode number, with Tracy Cass from Fire and Rescue New South Wales, who talked about that. And the phrase that I said to her is, it's an entirely different kettle of fish when what we teach most people is to run out of a burning building and your job is to run in the opposite direction into the burning building. We have to manage things differently.
Yeah, absolutely. I did listen to that episode. So, Tracy's great.
Awesome. Cool. So what's the future look like? What do you see on the horizon for the next 1 year, 5 years, and even 10 years? And you can introduce as much reality or as much optimism as you would like into your thoughts.
Well, people who know me, you know, if you're a startup founder, you're kind of like a raging optimist, right? So I'm an optimist to a fault. But I'm also someone who's been around for a little while now. So I started working in kind of more of a risk management role back in 2007.
Yeah,
that was a year after the Working Hours Code of Practice came out in Western Australia. Mm-hmm. And I was recruited into a role for a psychological consulting company who were anticipating that they were going to get a flood of work around fatigue risk management training and whatnot in 2007, given that the code of practice had just come out. But you know what? The work really didn't come in until around about 2009. So even though the code had been around, it took a while for companies to actually adopt it.
Yeah.
So here in WA, we had DEMAS release the FIFO code of practice for workplace mental health, which has a big risk management component. Yeah. I'm still yet to see many companies actually take that up and start adopting, you know, the principles behind it.
And we know that fly in, fly out work, or even drive in, drive out work, is particularly high risk for many reasons.
Yeah, that's right. And that was on the back of the parliamentary inquiry, right? When we had about 9 suicides happen on FIFO camps over the space of about 12 months. So
yeah,
really, the parliamentary inquiry identified that work and kind of like you say, the type of work that these people are doing, the remoteness of the work, is contributing to mental health issues. So employers actually have a responsibility to make sure that they are creating a healthy environment. And so we had a code of practice that had a big risk management focus that came out, but we're still yet to see companies adopt it. So even though this year, we're expecting, or hopefully the code of practice in New South Wales will get up around psychological health at work.
In 2021.
Yeah, hopefully that will come out. I know that they have received their consultation now, and they've made a number of amendments based on that consultation. So hopefully we'll see the next draft of that out, and hopefully it's released before the end of the year. We know that ISO 45003, Health and Safety at Work, is due imminently. Depending on who you talk to, you know, it's anywhere before June up until, you know, maybe late 2021, early 2022. Mm-hmm. We may be getting changes to the Workplace Health and Safety Act here in Australia that will incorporate more psychological health and safety. So there's all these things that are happening in this next year, right? It's just going to be interesting to see how long it takes for companies to adopt it. But, we're already working with some early adopters ourselves, mining companies, university. But I still think it's going to be, maybe 3 to 5 years before we see psychological health and safety more prominent. And that's really why we started the podcast, right? We really want to start educating people. Once people listen to the approach, they go, yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. Why are we still focusing on the individual? Why is it all, fruit bowls and yoga and, cupcakes on Are You Okay Day? And we think that we've done it, right? So the conversation that we've started, particularly on LinkedIn, has been fantastic. So we'll still keep pushing that information out, and we'll hopefully continue to educate people and balance the discussion a bit, so you don't just keep hearing all the wellness stuff, but you also hear about the risk management systemic kind of approaches as well. As optimistic as I am, and I'd love for 2021 to be the year, I still think it's probably 3 to 5 years before we see a big shift, but hopefully get those early adopters on board.
Awesome. And as we talked about, more than happy to come back and talk another time about how the role of learning and learning practices can actually not only help health and safety or more traditional health and safety outcomes, but it's actually a really ninja way to prove to a business how you can improve psychosocial reduce psychosocial risk and improve mental health as well. So we'll pause that conversation for another day. So last question for you then, given that I learned so much from the podcast through my own reflections and the guests that I'm able to talk with whilst it's a conversation with many thousands of health and safety professionals all over the world, what's one thing that has surprised you or been new for you in the discussions you've had with your guests so far?
I've got a confession to make on that, Andrew. I have been watching these people who have come on our podcast for the first, 9 or 10 episodes for quite a while, either, through my own network and chatting with them or watching them present at conferences. And my worldview has been shaped a lot by the people that we've had on so far. So you'll find we've deliberately gone out and brought people in who share the same worldview as us. So there's not a lot of surprise, if you like, from the things that they've brought out so far. I think for our audience, there's a lot of new stuff because, like I said, it's just so unfairly balanced in that wellness individual side of things when we talk about psychological health at work. So, but, this is my jam and this is something that really gets me out of bed in the morning. And I love talking to like-minded professionals, and the podcast has allowed us to do it and, record those conversations and share it with a much broader audience so that they can hear the things that we're hearing every day from these really intelligent people who've been doing it for years. I think a lot of people are going to go, 2021, that's when we started thinking about psychological health.
And Jason Fish, she predicted this would happen.
Yeah, but not to mention, the management standard came out in the UKHSC around stress in 1994, right? Like it's, 2004. So we've been having these discussions for, almost 20 years.
Yeah.
And not to mention the research around work design, predates that by decades as well. So, now we've been having these discussions around for years. It's not new. But what I think that maybe the psych health and safety side hasn't done so well in the past is market itself well. And so, we're hoping to bring some of that now to the game and don't bring a knife to a gunfight, gotta really get the message out there.
There could be a whole bunch of jokes about that with psychologists talking about bringing weapons. But anyway, we won't go there. So Jason, before we go on the Safety on Tap podcast, we always talk about takeaways, as practical as they can be. Although I find more and more I am reflecting and asking more questions of the listeners than giving specific advice, which I'm sure you can appreciate given that there's no one size fits all. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the practical experiences you've had, the starting points, the key areas or focuses or actions that you think can start to move the dial?
Yeah, I've actually written a implementation guide for psychological health and safety that resides on our website. So I would invite your listeners to download that. But the first thing that you need to get right is leadership commitment. And when we say leadership commitment for psychological health and safety, we're not saying they're giving you, a few thousand dollars a year to get your cupcakes and get a keynote speaker in for Are You Okay Day and pay for your EAP and that sort of thing. Or maybe even get up publicly and talk about a lived experience of poor mental health and mental illness.
Yeah.
That's not leadership commitment. Leadership commitment is that they've identified that psychosocial hazards pose a risk, and therefore they reside in your risk register as a company. It's not just the physical risks, but you're covering work-related stress, you're covering things like bullying, harassment, and other key psychosocial hazards.
Yeah.
The other way that they demonstrate leadership commitment is that they've ingrained it into policy and governance. You're not going to get the time or resources required as a professional to do psychological health and safety right unless there's policy that sits behind it. If you're, and I'm not one for, like Carlo, I'm not one for duplication. I think if you can kind of embed, psychological health and safety into existing governance or policies or procedures, then that's better. So just as simple as adding, we recognize that psychosocial health and safety is both a individual and an employer responsibility.
Yeah.
And so therefore we are going to commit to educating employees and we're going to commit to doing risk management of psychosocial hazards.
Sure.
And that's really what Marie Boland recommended in her review of the WHS Act. It was, let's not, come up with a whole new act for psychological health and safety at work. It's let's just add the term integrate psychological health a little bit more into the current act. Yep. So once you've got it at a policy governance level and it's in your risk register, you'll find it's far more easy when you want to work in this space to get time, budget and other resources required to do it well. Yeah. But I find, you know, without that real leadership support characterized by those things, what you'll find is that you just get the token. Oh yeah, you can do a lunch and learn here, or you can do that. It's not strategic. It's not systemic. So
And I talk about that idea that if it's not strategic, then not only are you not getting the attention of the right people, you're just not going to get resources to flow. That's how businesses work. So I think that that's very good advice. So leadership and that policy strategy piece. Is there anything else?
Yeah, no, there's heaps more, mate. But I'll try.
We don't have all day, so give us the highlights. Yeah,
I'll try and cap it. I know we're a longer format show than what yours is. So there's two other ones, though. One is to understand what you're already doing well and where the gaps exist. To assist with this, we actually created a free workplace mental health audit tool. You can find it at www.mentalhealthaudit.com. And basically just 14 questions that look at both the compliance related things, so generally under your duty of care provisions or might be required under WHS legislation, and your desirable things like your EAP and your, you know, keynotes and that sort of thing. So it's just a self-assessment, 14 questions, and at the end you'll find you get a report that shows you how many of these things you have in place and how you can address the identified gaps. So we point to free or affordable resources in that space. So the gap analysis is really good to go, yeah, we've already got these things in place, but there's all these other things that we could be doing. And most times I find when employees do it, they're like going, well, we've actually ticked all these boxes for stuff that isn't even an obligation. There's all these critical things that we should be doing, but we're not yet, which is like the risk assessment bit.
Yeah.
And the final thing I would suggest is to, you know, really increase your education around psychological health and safety. So that's one of the big reasons that we created the podcast, Psych Health and Safety, to really disseminate that information, not put it behind a paywall, make it really accessible and people can kind of do it on demand. So we find, like yourself, Andrew, it's a really good way to get messages out and, you know, for people to really upskill themselves. So we see it as a valuable PD source.
Awesome. And you get to connect with some interesting guests as well, so people can start to build their networks and who they're following and who they're reading, which is much bigger than just a single podcast, which I really appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Yeah, for your listeners, we do vet all the people that come on our show, so you're not going to hear fruit bowls and yogas from any of our guests. So we are.
What
now
do you mean you don't do chakras and energy fields and things like that?
Mate, maybe episode 1003 or something like that, when we're really getting to the bottom of the barrel, we might get into that. We now have people internationally who are reaching out to us wanting to, you know, share on the podcast, which is fantastic. But, you know, I'm making sure that Joelle does a really good vetting of them. She's more critical than I am. So, and the only real organizational psychologist of our team. So, she's vetting them before we have them on.
Yeah, awesome. Cool. Well, Jason Vichy, thanks for joining us on the Safety on Tap podcast, and all the best with the Psych Health and Safety podcast.
Great. Thanks, Andrew.
You've been listening to the Psych Health and Safety podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention, follow Flourish DX on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Psych Health and Safety podcast at www.psychhealthandsafety.com.